This is the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. We are joined by the author, freelance writer, Keith Bolander, who is the author of Cuba Under Siege, American Policy, the Revolution and Its People. Couldn't be more timely to be talking to Keith Bolander. How are you doing, Keith?
Very well. Thank
you,
Phil.
It's great to see you. I guess we have to. We were just speaking to Keith Ellis about the stability. I guess the strength. I started to use the word stability. The word is the strength of the Cuban system, its leadership and its people, following the passing of Fidel Castro, and the Americans seem to be hoping that. The great name is missing. Therefore, it'll be chaos. I said to Keith, they seem to have a cult of personality theory in the U.S. that if you don't have a famous person, then things are not going well. But I get the impression that Fidel builded well. Can you talk about what your impression of the? Of that system and how it works?
Yeah, it's one of the many misconceptions the Americans have always had about Cuba. And it's the one-man theory that Fidel ran everything on a day-to-day basis and that as soon as he was gone, the whole system would collapse.
Yes.
And that's one of the justifications why the Americans had the embargo on for such a long time, because they said as long as Fidel's in power, we will not negotiate with Cuba. Well, he's no longer in power. He's mm-hmm. passed, and the Americans still have no intention of lifting the embargo. This Cuban system's been around since 1959. It's very well established. It is supported by the majority of Cuban people. Raul Castro, Fidel's brother, is going to step down in 2018. The system will continue.
I like his expression. He says, 2018, I'm out of here.
Exactly. So there will be no Castros leading the Cuban nation, and still the revolution will continue. It will change.
Can you imagine? This is going to be rich territory for pundits, right? Because they can start making stuff up, new stuff.
Well, you look at
they've been had old material.
You look at how the American media and the Canadian media covered Fidel's passing, and there was this. It was particularly some of the stuff that was written in the Toronto Star.
Mm-hmm. They sent their sports writer.
Yeah. Yes. And she did a fine job covering sports in Cuba. And the underlying thing was, well, now Fidel's out of the way. He's gone. Now things will progress. It's not going to happen that way unless the Americans end the embargo. And now their excuse is, well, Raul's still in power, so we still have to deal with a Castro. Mm-hmm. Who knows what's going to happen in 2018? Maybe they'll blame, the dog will still, Fidel's or Raul's dog will be in power, so then they'll blame that. It's just one in a very long line of rational excuses that the Americans have had to maintain the embargo.
Yes. And by the way, what an interesting time to be to assess Fidel, his approach, his style. By the way, I wish everybody could master his style. He's a totally democratic kind of guy. He had a feel for people. He heard them. He saw them. He gave people such confidence. Here we have a news. We thought we were on the cusp of something, a breakthrough. Obama goes, and there's talk. But then we all noticed that the embargo was not lifted. That everything, sanctions remain in place. And lo and behold, now we have this guy called Trump. And he is talking about bringing a new ball game. We don't know. His language is rather hostile, as I understand it. Assessed who he has around him and what their view of Cuba is?
There's tremendous concern in Cuba and among the pro-Cuban supporters what Trump will do. I mean, he's an empty vessel, so there's no way to create any sort of opinion about what he's going to do politically, because he has no political background. But so then you look at who he's surrounding himself with.
Yes.
And unfortunately, one of the first people he surrounded himself with is Mauricio Claver Caron, who is an extreme anti-revolutionary Cuban-American born in the United States, and he is a senior advisor to Trump. Now, Mauricio runs a PAC and has donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Republican Party. So if he's the expert Trump is looking to determine what he's going to do with Cuban policy, we're all very concerned because Mauricio Clavel Caron is extremely opposed to the normalization process, what Obama did, mm-hmm. and supports the non-engagement of Cuba going back to the worst days of the Cold War. So the signs don't look promising. We can hope that Trump, the businessman, will supersede Trump, the politician, and see the business value and the benefits of continuing the normalization process. But I have my pessimism and my fear that he may rescind all of Obama's executive orders. And you're right, the embargo is still in place. President Obama eased the embargo and made it easier for Americans to travel to Cuba, but the embargo is still in place. And in fact,
there's still a big brother factor. It's not your constitutional right to travel. Go ahead and travel. We won't prosecute.
Well,
but Trump didn't promise you that anyway. So 6 months from now, you might have to worry.
Yeah, and the Cuban American community is a little concerned too, because under Obama, they've been allowed to go back and forth to Cuba with no restrictions whatsoever. Under Bush, they could only go once every 3 years, and there was a lot of restrictions. So will Trump return to that policy? And now it's quite easy for an American to go to Cuba. All he has to do is go on the internet and fill out a licensing agreement, and he can go to Cuba. Trump could turn that back too. So there's a lot of unknown and a lot of concern within those who support the process.
Yeah. Fidel, in his last period of time that he was still writing and he was still making the occasional comment. He appeared at I forget what year of the meeting of the last he attended of the Communist Party. It might have been the youth section of the party. He was remaining highly clear in his thought and his approach. I noticed Obama didn't see him, and his last assessment was kind of the good cop, bad cop, you might say, between him and his brother, because Raul was nice to Obama. They had some nice moments together, some curious moments together, if people remember the picture of the dangling hand. I noticed that Fidel did get in a last good sharp remark, which was, okay, but we don't need them. We're not we're not begging them for anything. And we think, that system isn't going to change.
Well, the Cuban Revolution has survived since the earliest days with American hostility. They'd be much better off with American friendship. But Fidel's position was we would like normal relations. He's always come out and supported normal relations. But the revolution and the Cuban society will continue, and they're not begging the Americans to normalize relations. Hopefully it will happen, but one of Fidel's last comments, as you mentioned, is that he supported the process, but it was from a position of equals. And mm-hmm. that's all Fidel always asked for, to be treated with respect, to have Cuba treated as a sovereign country and not being dictated to by any outside force, most specifically the United States.
What? We all, historians will recall, I started to say we all recall, there's a vast part of the planet actually I realized weren't around when this happened, but I was. But he met Richard Nixon, and that's exactly what he told him, right? I mean, actually, Fidel was prepared, let's get along. But by that time, the U.S. had already taken Cuban airplanes, had seized them. When Fidel began to make his announcements fulfilling promises not within decades but within a year of taking power with the revolution, they began to actually introduce land reform. And land reform drove the Americans crazy, because that was the King Ranch and the United Fruit Company, is my memory.
And Fidel made it very clear, even before the revolution triumphed, that was going to be one of his main policies.
They thought he was kidding.
Yeah, urban land reform. What upset the Americans was that Fidel didn't turn out to be a Batista light. He was not going to abide by the continuation of American hegemony over Cuba. And he made it very clear. So the meeting with Richard Nixon was only a couple months after the triumph of the revolution. And the Americans had already decided Fidel has to go and the revolution has to end because it wasn't abiding by the same rules as before. Well, that was 55 years ago and they're still not. And the Americans still haven't forgiven.
Yes. And it looks like we're going to – the next few chapters might be as colorful as the previous. Now we're speaking to Keith Bolander, by the way, author of Cuba Under Siege and the previous book, Voices from the Other Side. And Keith, by the way, you really did us a service. That book, Voices from the Other Side, we're telling about based on interviews with families who lost loved ones to terrorism. Terrorism, which is a popular subject right now. It wasn't at the time, some years back. And these were individuals and organizations operating out of Miami who, together with U.S. intelligence, killed a lot of Cubans. And I think people should get that book because we have clearly we're entering a phase where this seems to be a possibility of recurring, but I want to ask you, what do you know? What are your thoughts about that Cuban community? You say one of them is now a member of is an advisor to Trump, but they still represent a threat, do they not? I mean, they're still not being closed down, to my knowledge.
They're still an extreme, hardcore, limited amount of right-wing Cuban Americans who oppose anything to do with the revolution. And unfortunately, a couple of the Cuban American congressmen carry a great deal of influence when it comes to Cuban policy. So for example, Marco Rubio, who's had his issues with President-elect Trump, and Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, they sit on the foreign relations committees in the House and the Senate, and they're looked on as the experts towards Cuban policy. So again, it all gets back to who Trump is going to ask and
this
bring
mysterious
in.
Mysterious man.
Yeah, and if he says, well, you know, Marco Rubio, we've had our differences in the past, but what's your opinion about Cuba? And Marco says, well, end the process, end engagement. He turns to Ileana, she says the same thing. Will Trump just say, well, you guys are the experts, let's end the process? And that gives a huge victory to this limited minority of Cuban Americans who don't want to engage, because the vast majority of Cuban Americans now, poll after poll, show they want normal relations with Cuba. They want to go back and visit their family and friends and come back to the United States.
So there's going to be Cubans and real Cubans.
Well, the demographics are shifting considerably when there's still, you know, some debate whether Hillary won the Cuban American vote or did Trump. I think Hillary did, because there's so many more Cuban Americans of a younger generation that want to engage. It's the hard right, the first generation exiles, the older Cuban Americans who will never forget or forgive and don't want anything to do with engagement. Yeah. They're dying out, and hopefully the younger generation of Cuban Americans will actually have an influence on policy because
isn't it possible, too, that the tide will go out on that in terms of the demographic support, and it turn out that it is actually U.S. intelligence that wants to have this problem with the Cuban? I was thinking this one of the authors, it might be you, I've been reading too many things lately, but one of them pointed out that this money that many of the Cuban Americans have and worked in the Republican Party was funneled to them originally for their anti-Fidel work on the promise that or the understanding that they would work for the Republican Party.
Yeah, it's closing
of
the circle.
Circle.
Oh, absolutely. There's millions and millions.
So there's
and
a lot
millions.
Of money in being an anti-Castro Cuban.
Well, there's a lot of people, Cuban Americans, who've become very rich by positioning themselves.
Hiring other Cubans to try to kill other Cubans.
Well, they can also obtain government funding. They can get donations, and they turn it back to the party that supports the non-engagement, which has most historically been the Republican. So the government helps, especially under Ronald Reagan in the 80s, there was millions and millions of dollars put into institutions like Radio Marti, others that made a lot of people rich only because they objected to any sort of dialogue with Cuba. And there's still a lot of Cuban Americans who are making a lot of money on that policy. And that's an effect. That's a really huge influence on ending the process, the normalization process that Obama started, and going back to the days of non-engagement.
Mm-hmm. We should remind people, we were just speaking to Keith Ellis about this, and he said, well, you know, Obama basically talked out of both sides of his mouth, but he said he could have ended the embargo. The embargo was going on. And then, but there, I noticed that Raul, in his statement at the time and subsequently, has included a rather important point, which Americans definitely don't want to hear about, which is Guantanamo belongs to Cuba. He didn't say we're going to take that because they're not that foolish. However, they're not – it's kind of like, what is it, Gibraltar? this really matters to Cubans.
Very much so. And it is a negotiating point. Every time the Cubans and the Americans have sat down in the last 2 years, the Cubans always bring it up. You cannot have true normal relations if Guantanamo Bay is still in the hands of the United States. To me, it's a negotiating position because the Americans are not going to return Guantanamo Bay anytime soon. I can't see any scenario.
Maybe after Okinawa.
Well – and there's – yeah, we're waiting a long time
or,
for that.
Taiwan.
and there has been criticism of Obama that he hasn't done enough. The embargo is still in the hands of the Congress. It has to come from Congress. There has to be legislation from Congress to end the embargo. I take the positive side. Obama could have done a lot more, and there are things that he made worse. The international banks are still being fined millions and millions of dollars. But at least he took the step to engage Cuba, to sit down at the table across from the Cubans and talk to them. And you have to give him credit for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did it happen? Did he went, which is rather humbling. An American president visits Cuba and Fidel is still alive and there. Now, Keith, here's a $64,000 – that used to be a valuable amount of money. A $64 million question is – you're looking at this issue. You've written two wonderful books. One of them is Cuba Under Siege, and it's under my nose here. What should we be – what you as a writer, if you follow these things, what are you thinking you would like to write about? What do you think the next kind of book or thesis for you is? Because you're one of the people who we turn to for this.
Well, I've been working on it for the last 2 years, and it should be out next year, is how the mainstream media, not just the United States, but the mainstream Western mainstream media has covered the Cuban Revolution since the early days up to the normalization process. And now I've got another chapter dealing with how they've covered the passing of Fidel. And it's created – it has the historical significance that it has created so much misinformation about the Cuban reality. And that's why the average American and so many journalists come into the Cuban subject with preconceived ideas, mostly negative. And it's been a real shame and a real block towards the ability of the United States and Cuba to negotiate and get together. The media has played such an important role in creating so much anti-Cuban propaganda.
Yeah. And we have to say, you pointed out, it was painful to read the Globe and the Star and forget the National Post, but it just the patronizing ignorance. These were lowbrow, I'd call them, writers who already had the story written before they left. So that isn't a very encouraging sign. I mean, by the way, you've written for the Toronto Star. I don't know why they didn't ask you to at least write them a feature on this matter. But the media is it's a worrying thing. How quickly they simply take up the line. I don't see as much a buffer of people who are turned to ask for let's reconsider or how about another tact. It seems to be much more attack dog writing. I mean, it's just, let's make sure the word dictator is there. Let's make sure There's not enough food. Let's make sure, you know, some sort of story like that.
Because the media always comes towards Cuba with that perspective. They're prohibited from putting context, from putting meaning into the history of the revolution, because it would destroy their dialogue. So you see, I was in London at the time, and the media over there was just as bad, if not worse, doing exactly what you described. The first paragraph would always say dictator, communist, all these terrible things. And then there would be absolutely no context about how the Cuban society has survived under 50 years of American hostility, the terrorist acts, everything else, the embargo, because that's not the media's purpose. The media's purpose is to present Cuba, in particular Cuba, in a certain way to reinforce how the ruling elites politically and the economics want to describe what Cuba is all about. And you just see that constantly.
It's our culture that is walking in lockstep. Our parliament, our parliamentarians embarrassed us all in front of the world with the way they talked, including all of our, let's call them, what, Social Democrat. That was embarrassing.
Well, look at what Prime Minister Trudeau commented on and the backlash he received. It was incredible.
He got in trouble for having a father. Keith Bolander, boy, it's great to see you. Thank you very much for coming. This has been the Taylor Report, and Hani is not going to be coming back in the future, but we look forward to her visits occasionally, at least. So we'll see you next time.